you've likely seen the news coverage of a newly released and quite shocking climate change study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science Journal. It's been dubbed Hot House Earth, with headlines breathlessly declaring hell on earth, paradise lost, and worse. But the study could just as easily have been dubbed using the other term discussed by its authors, stabilized earth. But only if we heed their warnings and take actions outlined in the study. We're joined today by one of the report's authors. Professor Diana Liverman teaches in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona Tucson. She's co-author of the new report. It's entitled Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. Thanks for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome.
So let's start with the decision to put out this study, the basics of the study, and what you found.
Yes, of course. Well, we're a group of scientists from all around the world, and we've actually been, many of us have been working together for a number of years, trying to figure out what's happening to the Earth system and what our choices are that we can do about it. So a couple of years ago, we had a workshop, we looked at where the research was right now, and we started to realize that there was a lot of new research that would help us understand where we're going. The basic theme of the paper is that we already know that human activity, mostly fossil fuel emissions, has warmed the Earth by 1 degree. But what we brought together in the study is that by warming the planet, we're setting off some natural processes that could add to that warming. And that's what potentially could take us to the hothouse Earth scenario, which is, for example, as we warm the planet, we're starting to see the permafrost melting in the Arctic, the frozen ground. That's got methane in it, which is also a warming gas. So if that gets released as the ground melts, that's going to add some extra temperature to the warming already happening. Another example would be, as the Earth warms, the rainforests and other forests around the world start to dry out, they can die back. And if that happens, that's another burst of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So that also adds to the warming. And what we do in the paper is we've got 8 to 10 different feedbacks that if they all kick in over the next 100 to 200 years, that could take us, it could double the warming that humans are directly causing. And that's what takes us to a 4 or 5 degree, a 9 or 10 degree Fahrenheit warming that we call hothouse Earth.
And the difference,
but we've also,
go
ahead.
Well, so the difference in this study and in previous looks at how quickly we will get to too high of a concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere to essentially make the planet habitable for us, are that you looked at this feedback loop. So most of the studies have simply looked at the first set of trajectories, ice melting. Is that right?
Most of the studies are based on computer models where they increase the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in line with the burning of coal, the growing of rice, other things that are human activities that are putting gases into the atmosphere. But a lot of the models don't include these feedback loops where the human-caused warming triggers these cycles in the natural environment that add to our warming. We didn't do original research for the study, but what we did was bring together all of the latest research on all of these different feedbacks and combine that with what we know about what humans are doing directly. And that's what took us to this rather worrying scenario of hothouse Earth.
And what that then found was a speeding up of the previously predicted trajectory of how quickly we could be reaching too high of a concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere?
Yes, it could lead to quite rapid warming because once these feedbacks start to kick in, it's like a domino effect where the extra warming from one takes us to the next feedback. So, and although we don't say that we're in that rapid warming yet, we do suggest that we're only perhaps a half to 1 degree away, which we could get to within 1 or 2 decades. So we're still in a period where we have a choice to try to avoid that scenario.
So I want to clarify for our listeners, when you talk about degrees, you're talking centigrade?
Yes. the current goal of the international agreement is 2 degrees centigrade, which is about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and the hothouse Earth scenario, which we partly based on looking back into the deep past. We said, okay, in the past, when we had 400 or 500 parts per million of greenhouse gases, that's sort of what we're looking at having in the atmosphere. What was the Earth like then? And we looked back, and from the fossil record, it's about 4 or 5 degrees centigrade, which is sort of 9 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
And so, by the agreement, you mean the Paris Climate Agreement, which agreed to limit an attempt to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius with the goal of 1.5 degrees.
Yes, the Paris Agreement says that we should try for under 2 degrees and if possible 1.5. The problem right now is that the commitments that countries have made, which are all voluntary, still aren't enough. And so we're looking at 3.5 degrees centigrade under the Paris Agreement at the moment, unless we ramp up the ambition, unless countries agree to do more.
So can you just kind of like spell out in practical terms the difference between that 2 degree centigrade, 3.5 degree Fahrenheit temperature rise, and the scenario you're painting where it's closer to 9 or 10 Fahrenheit, aside from days are hotter on average everywhere, what would be the practical impacts?
Well, of course, climate change doesn't just occur as an average. We also get higher extremes. And we've been seeing that this summer, where even with the 1 degree of warming we've got, you can get much higher temperatures. So extremes increase as well. But in terms of the impacts, if you look at that sort of hothouse Earth scenario, you're looking at real devastation to natural ecosystems. If it was the change occurred over a very long period of time, they might adjust. You'd start to see the forests moving north, for example, but the rapidity of change will be too great for many ecosystems to adjust. Similarly, agriculture will be really challenged in that sort of warm scenario. You'd meet the limits to quite a lot of different crops being able to produce under those high temperatures. And there would clearly be very serious impacts for human health when you're in those very high temperature extremes. We're seeing this summer across Europe and North America some of the problems when people come under extreme heat stress, particularly vulnerable populations like the elderly or the poor who can't afford air conditioning. So you're seeing very extreme impacts under that hothouse Earth scenario. We're not saying it's the end of humanity. In some regions and some people would be able to find ways to live comfortably in that environment, but they'd be paying a lot more for air conditioning, a lot more for food, and they'd be competing a lot more for water.
Well, and also the study says that essentially we're on potentially a much faster trajectory to get to those worst case scenarios and experiencing them faster than was previously anticipated. And those are issues, as you've laid out. There are food shortages, drought, drying up of agricultural sectors, people being forced to move through immigration and refugee status, of getting to other places where it is more hospitable to live, sea level rise, rising on the coasts, fires, extremes in weather, all of those concerns that we've seen written about previously, but on a faster potential trajectory. Is that right?
Yeah, it's faster and more extreme because of the sort of double whammy of what humans are doing and how we're triggering those feedbacks. And yes, sea level rise is a concern. Depending on how you look at the literature, it could be under hothouse Earth around 20 meters, that's more than 60 feet of sea level rise. And with that level of sea level rise, you would wipe out quite a lot of coastal cities. And a lot of our global agriculture, particularly rice production, is grown under that elevation.
So hothouse Earth has gotten a lot of press attention for this extreme risk, extreme scenario. But there's another piece of this paper that I feel has gotten lost, and that's the other scenario, which you call in the paper stabilized Earth, and that scenario is possible by decisions that you also lay out in the paper. So can you talk about, you know, the sources of emissions or the sources of the cause of climate change that are pointed to as most important to target, and social, economic, political changes that would need to happen to achieve stabilized Earth?
Yes, and thank you for giving me the chance to talk about stabilized Earth, because most people don't want to talk about the optimistic scenario, strangely. So as I said, the paper doesn't say that we've locked ourselves into the hothouse Earth trajectory by any means. And in fact, if we fulfilled the lower end of the Paris Agreement, if we got to 1.5 degree warming and kept it there, we could probably keep the Earth in a pretty stable condition, which would mean the temperatures might stop rising. We might prevent these natural feedbacks kicking in, and we might be able to reduce the level of sea level rise. We do say that the stable Earth might be a little bit warmer than we are right now, and that would mean we'd have to do a lot in terms of thinking about how we'd adapt to living on that slightly warmer Earth. But the stabilized Earth is certainly possible. But in order to get there, we've got to work much harder at finding alternatives to fossil fuels, to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, or to finding ways to take the greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And one of the things we emphasize in the paper is it's not just reducing or ending fossil fuel emissions. It's also protecting the parts of the biosphere that currently take up greenhouse gases. So, for example, forests and oceans take a lot of our greenhouse gas emissions out of the ocean, out of the atmosphere, sorry. And what we need to do is to make sure that we protect the forests, that we protect the natural systems that are absorbing. They're what we call sinks. They're taking the greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So if we reduce emissions and protect the forest and land and ocean sinks, then we could end up with a much more stable Earth condition. And the good news in the paper is actually the last part of the paper. We look for signs of what we call the social feedbacks. And these would be feedbacks that are happening in our social and economic system that are actually moving us to reducing emissions and protecting sinks, and that are already moving us towards the stable trajectory. So that's sort of the good news part of the paper, is that we see signs of the social feedbacks that can actually help us avoid hothouse Earth.
Can you talk more about that, the social and economic aspects?
Yes. So some of the examples we point to is dramatic increases in energy efficiency across the world. So most of the world's economies are now producing at a much lower level of greenhouse gas emissions. And that's because we have more efficient industrial systems, more efficient energy systems. And that's going in a really helpful trajectory. Another example would be that in many parts of the world, we're starting to see really serious efforts to protect forests. Lots of countries are expanding their forest areas. Some of them are getting international finance to protect forests. And so you see in countries like Brazil, where they've slowed down deforestation pretty significantly over the last couple of decades. Another example that a lot of people don't aren't aware of and don't think about is a lot of people assume that the main thing that's driving our greenhouse gas emissions is population growth. But in fact, over the last two decades, the number of children that each woman has around the world has dropped incredibly dramatically. We've gone from an average of more than 5 children per woman to only about, it's halved to about 2.5. So this is what we call fertility, and that has dropped dramatically, which means that population growth is slowing. And in fact, we may level off population in the middle of the century. So one of the things I like to tell people is don't focus on population, because the women of the world have already sorted that out. Mm-hmm. With enough high status for women, with them being able to make choices, with them having jobs and education, they choose to have less children. And that really reduces that particular driver of our greenhouse gas emissions and takes us to stable Earth.
Mm. And then also the economic forces you discuss, so that one problem to be addressed is an economic model based on consumption and GDP growth.
Yes. And I think here we need to not make the assumption that all consumption is bad for the climate. There are growing areas of consumption that have much lower environmental impact. The fact that we can do this interview on the internet, the electronic communication has the potential to reduce the amount of travel, for example. People are consuming digital media rather than consuming higher impact consumer goods. But there is an issue here in that one of the great successes of the last 25 years is that millions of people have come out of poverty across the developing world. Poverty rates have actually halved across the world. But as people come out of poverty, they do consume more, and they can consume more greenhouse gas emissions. So it's how can we find lower carbon, lower emission paths out of poverty for those people who are moving into better conditions.
So reducing consumption of fossil fuel dominated energy, and reducing and shifting from a model that's based on inherently based on consumption growth of all forms, including fossil fuel consumption growth, as the basis of our economic well-being measures.
Yeah, it doesn't mean consumption can't grow. You could consume renewable energy, for example, at much lower environmental impact. There are, of course, issues around as people aspire to higher consumption in many parts of the world, people then start to eat more meat and dairy, and that drives greenhouse gas emissions. So lower diets that consume less meat are another way you could increase your consumption, perhaps without increasing so much meat and dairy. So we're not trying to say, you know, we can't consume anything. We're trying to say, choose forms of consumption that have a lower environmental impact.
And so the paper paints both this somewhat terrifying scenario, but in another sense, a very hopeful scenario. Why do you think that most of the focus has been on the devastating scenario?
Well, I should probably ask you that because you're in the media. But I think sometimes that the bad news stories get more attention. But of course, the paper came out and we didn't design it this way. The paper's been going through that long sort of scientific review process. We didn't know it was going to come out in a month where temperature records were being broken everywhere, where, you know, the Northern Hemisphere had these devastating fires and heat waves. So I think also people were sort of linking what they were seeing, for example, with the fires in California to this concept of hothouse Earth. And I also think the choice of the word hothouse Earth, we didn't, again, like, strategize about that, but it certainly catches the attention. And perhaps stabilized Earth is a more boring term. But people, you know, people do worry about the apocalypse. I know many people with young children are very concerned about what's happening to the climate. But because the media picked up on the more dramatic scenario, one of the things that I know a lot of climate scientists worry about is we're not trying to terrify people. We don't want this to happen. We're not happy to see these apocalyptic scenarios. We'd far rather be talking about the more stable and optimistic scenarios with people. And we don't want to scare people. We do want people to make good choices, and many of us would choose to act for stable Earth, but we're also not trying to tell people you have to do this. We're saying, here, if we do this, this will happen. If we do this, this will happen. You make a choice about the future you want.
You know, I have to say, even comparing your paper to the reports that come out of the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which are consensus-based, kind of lowest common denominator, let's only claim the things we can be absolutely certain of documents, it does seem like the world of climate science communication has erred far too much on the side of not sounding the alarm.
Yes. My friend Kevin Anderson has written a couple of things recently that says that actually scientists are sort of playing down how bad it's going to be, and we should be more honest, for example, about what the sort of extreme cases are, and also about the severity of the changes that we need to make to avoid those extreme scenarios. I mean, I would say I'm currently an author of the next IPCC report that's going to come out in October, and it's a report on whether we can keep warming under 1.5 degrees. Mm. And I would say that that report has conclusions that are pretty consistent with our paper and about the challenges of staying under 1.5. But we definitely spend a lot of time exploring how to keep emissions low. I think the other thing that happens is that IPCC actually produces three reports each time, and the media always tend to focus on the climate science report, which does look at all these very terrifying scenarios. But if you actually look at the other reports on adaptation or on mitigation, on reducing emissions, they're full of great ideas for how we can help people adapt to climate change, how we can bring down emissions, what's happening in different countries around energy efficiency and technology. So sometimes, again, it depends where you look in the paper or where you look in the reports as to how negative one might interpret what the scientists are saying.
Great. Well, that's a really important point, and the one we're going to have to leave it on. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Our guest is Professor Diane Liverman. She teaches in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona, Tucson. She's co-author of the new paper published in the National Academy of Sciences titled Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.